is Leon Bortler interviewing Chevis Walling in Washington, D.C. on September 12, 1979. Professor Walling is currently Distinguished Professor of Chemistry at the University of Utah and is also editor of the Journal of the American Chemical Society. I know you were born in Evanston, Illinois in 1916, but I know almost nothing else about your family. And so if I could ask you, whatever part of your family you want to start with, you have brothers and sisters. And
I have a sister and two brothers. My two brothers are not dead. I was the youngest of four.
Okay, can you give me their names, and so just for the...
Willoughby Haskell Walling and William English Walling III, two brothers. Sister's name was Frederica Christina.
Your father, can you tell me a little bit about his education, what he did?
He was a graduate of the University of Chicago.
I think I got that part on. He was a graduate of the University of Chicago.
He was a graduate of the University of Chicago. He went briefly to Harvard Law School, but never took a degree. He was a banker in Chicago, really. Mm-hmm. He was also quite active in civic and philanthropic affairs.
Mm-hmm. I think you best give me his name too before we do it.
Willoughby George Walling.
Okay.
His brother, his name is William English Walling, was a prominent early socialist.
Uh huh. Okay. An interesting fact that won't be found anywhere else.
Quite well known. He wrote quite a lot.
Okay. Are there any particular ways in which your father might have influenced you in what you...
Well, certainly not particularly with an interest in science. There had been a good many doctors, indeed, in the family. And I think either he or my mother would have been pleased had I gone into medicine, which I had never very seriously contemplated. My mother came from South Carolina. My father was a judge, and he was in South Carolina politics. Mm-hmm. Having fought in the Civil War, he was surrendered to Confederate cavalry at Appomattox. Was the last thing
he did. A claim to fame. Your mother's name, just for the record.
Frederica Christina Haskell. I'm one of the few chemists in the profession who actually came from fairly well-to-do family.
That's not all that true. but it's sort of a mixed bag. Yeah. Of the people I've interviewed, it's sort of been a mixed thing. But it is interesting that a good number have come from people who were not wanting, at any rate. I think. And so they could at least provide for them in terms of their education.
They had to be well enough off to get an education.
To get an education. Yeah. And of course, the ones I've talked to have gone to places like Harvard and the better private schools and so on.
They tend to come from families that are sort of on the way up and believe in education.
Yes. Okay. So your family was relatively well educated before that.
Yeah.
Do you remember, you then grew up in Evanston?
I grew up in Winnetka.
In Winnetka, yeah. Okay. And can you remember something of what it was like in terms of what one did in Winnetka, and what about your schooling and particularly influential teachers?
I started out in the public schools, and after Winnetka has a very public school system. But in fifth grade, I started going to private school, North Shore Country Day, which is another good high school or college preparatory school. Went there for the rest of my time. I would say that I was interested in science ever since I learned how to read, but it wasn't until I was in about fifth grade and learned how to make gunpowder that chemistry was science that you could actually do something. I really stuck with it ever since. So mm-hmm. I really knew I wanted to do this very, very early in my career. Mm-hmm. Didn't really get a great deal of intensive or very good science education in before I got to college. There was some rather good sort of introduction to it. Astronomy and things like this in elementary school, but the only science, real science course I took in high school was physics. I never had any chemistry in high school. I taught it to myself and, mm-hmm. talked myself into the course at Harvard, which assumed you had high school chemistry, which really just meant you had to balance equations.
Yeah, yeah. But you'd, it's interesting that you'd manage to learn all that on yourself. Anyone that aside from your own interest, anyone that sort of took an interest in your interest in science or in chemistry at that level and fostered your interest?
Not that really had much of an effect on me. The school was sympathetic, but mm-hmm. didn't do much more than that.
So because of your family's financial position, you certainly didn't feel you missed any experiences as a result of being anyway. I assume because of the education in your family that you expected to go to college from an early age.
Yeah.
Did you consider other institutions besides Harvard?
Not very seriously. I had an older brother. Well, my older brother, one of them started in Harvard, although he only lasted about the mid-years. He was not much of a scholar. He had a very good time, but he was there. Most of my friends went east to college. Actually, as I remember, out of about 14 boys in the senior class, about six of them went to Harvard. Those days it was easy.
Yeah.
You had $400 tuition and did all right on the college boards, you got in.
I suppose being a Midwesterner helped too. They were trying to distribute things. Can you tell me something about life as an undergraduate at Harvard? And, went there when? About
1933. Yeah. Well, I roomed with one of my high school classmates, who also was a chemistry major, so we sort of had that to keep us interested. The advisor to my freshman year, Henry Bent, Sr., was then at Harvard, my advisor. He was mm-hmm. physical chemist from another different field, and I really fascinated him by telling him how we'd arranged a Model A Ford so you could spray stannic chloride into the exhaust pipe. That this may such an effective smoke screen. We only did this experiment once. I mean, I always had a certain number of extracurricular chemical projects going on. And but then I persuaded Louis Feaser, who was then teaching the advanced for the one semester freshman general chemistry for people who had high school chemistry, that I could take that course, and then I had him in organic, and he had quite an effect because he really gave the students the feel that here was an interesting and exciting subject. He was mm-hmm. a very effective teacher in making the subject look interesting and looking for something he enjoyed immensely.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine you've heard this from
yeah, I think I've,
many other people.
I've heard that from others. This is a little bit later on, but I noticed you had a couple of publications around 1935 with a fellow named Sir Harold Fisher.
Yeah, yeah.
And somehow I've missed him in looking through the
catalog. How did that happen? He was instructor at Harvard at that point. He was in charge of the undergraduate lab.
Mm-hmm.
Or he was one of the he had his PhD, he was an instructor. And they would let some of the better students in the organic course, do some independent research rather than the regular laboratory. He sort of took me under his wing and did some things with him, how that happened.
I see. And he, obviously he didn't stay on very long. That was
he didn't stay on. He's at the meeting now. He went to the Department of Agriculture.
I see.
And mm-hmm. I think had quite a successful career.
Mm-hmm.
He was in charge of one of their laboratories for a long time.
What about other courses at Harvard at the time that may have influenced you, either in science or outside of science?
Well, I was certainly taken by organic chemistry very early. Marvelous reading, which I had a marvelous book named Creative Chemistry, written by E. Slosson.
That's interesting.
Which came out after World War I.
In the 20s, that's right. Paul Bartlett mentioned the same book.
And I read that as a kid, and I was very impressed by that. And from that, I think I learned how to draw structural formulas and discovered that isomers existed, but there was more than two ways of drawing some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And the science books I read were that, and then I also read Eddington and Jeans rather extensively when I was in high school. But coming back to Harvard, the advanced organic course with Newton Kohler, which paid some attention to reaction mechanisms, I found a very inspirational kind of a course.
Yeah, how did you find Kohler?
Well, Krusty, I also did some independent research in that one with, although it never led to anything that got published. I don't remember the name of the man with the head of the laboratory there. Tischler. Max Tischler was. He was also a friend of Hap Fisher, so I got to know him quite well when I was a sophomore. So these people all had some effect on me. Because Bartlett was a graduate student when I was an undergraduate. I don't know when
He finished off in about 1930. Did not return until about 1934. He was at Minnesota when you first started.
Well, I know. I didn't really. Well, I guess I'd met him when he'd come back to the staff, but I never got to know him while I was an undergraduate.
Yeah, yeah. He was just fresh to the staff.
Physical chemistry, I found less rewarding, but it was something of a challenge to figure out. And quantitative analysis I regarded as a good test of whether I was serious about chemistry. I was ready to put up with that. G.P. Baxter taught the...
Was Kistikowski teaching? Or someone else? Or
Bennett. Was still teaching chemistry when I was... I think it was junior.
You weren't treated to Forbes then?
No. The other, well, those are the major ones one took. Took a course in industrial chemistry with, I don't remember the name of the old gentleman who taught that, but that
battery, what? No, that wasn't. I know who it is. Okay.
It was rather interesting, and I've actually seen some the plant trips was the interesting part of that. I took a course.
Well, Willie had actually the same course, and he'd only taken it 20 years before you had.
And I took a biochemistry course. I guess Henderson was in charge of it, but they had something of a variety of lectures.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any of the textbooks that you used during that period?
Coleman was the organic text. That's the one I can found. Hammett's solution of electrolytes was turned up in qualitative analysis. Those are the only ones I can remember.
Um,
mentioned that that Kohler's course was at least oriented a little toward mechanisms.
At least to the point of figuring out what the intermediates were in chemical reactions.
I'm trying to develop that because apparently he had an influence on a number of people.
There's a good deal of stereochemistry in it, and there's a good deal of questions like 1,2 versus 1,4 addition, these kind of problems.
Why
do you observe one thing in one case and another in another?
You had decided to become a chemist rather early in life.
Yeah.
What were your perceptions of being a chemist at that particular time, when you were in college? What do you think chemists did? what could you see?
I hoped I would teach. I hoped I'd be able to get a teaching position, but they were rather fuzzy, and I was good many people tried to discourage me and told me that chemists did more analysis in the back end of large factories. I think it was probably true for a good many of them. I didn't really have a very clear idea of what they did. If I could find a way of doing this, I wanted to do it.
Okay. Well, you didn't feel embarrassed by that. I haven't talked to a person yet who really had a clear idea of what it was like. Do you have any friends from undergraduate days that you remember? Any that became chemists or went on to graduate school that you remember well?
Paul Cohen was the only classmate of mine who, I think, has gone on to a very notable chemistry career. There are people I've seen occasionally. Ned Riddle and another fellow both went to Roman Haas. I think they both went to Illinois and got their PhDs. Probably Morris Zipf, who is now inorganic companies, but had an interesting paper in Chemtech recently about producing extraordinarily pure things they need to make optical glasses.
Mm-hmm.
But there weren't many my classmates who went on into chemistry. There, as now, a good many chemistry majors went on into medicine.
Mm-hmm. When did you decide to go to graduate school?
Well, I thought I wanted to if I were doing well. Because obviously if I was going to teach, I need to.
And how did you make a choice of which graduate school to go to?
My father was a great promoter of Chicago, so I inquired around and found that Chicago had a perfect graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it might be nice to go down home, near home, so I was offered a fellowship at Harvard, but
you were offered a fellowship at Harvard.
But so I called my father and said, "Do you want to support me at Chicago or should I take a fellowship?" He said he'd be glad to support me at Chicago.
Well, that's very generous of you.
Only cost $300.
Oh, that's different than today. Chicago must have been a pretty exciting place for a young chemist at that point. Can you tell me something about it and your experiences there?
It was somewhat mixed. I talked to Max Tischler, and then he said he thought the most interesting work there was being done by Karas. So in the spring of my senior year, I was home on vacation. I visited the chemistry department and talked to him. The procedure was pretty simple in those days, because all I did then was to turn up at registration and pay my tuition and say I wanted to go to graduate school. Bringing my diploma with me, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think at that point they wrote Harvard to find out.
I see. Well, they didn't even have to apply for admission in advance or
No, so that wasn't applying for teaching us.
I see.
Fellowship.
Uh-huh. That's interesting.
Of which there weren't very many.
Mm-hmm.
So Kailash was sort of pre-selected for me as the most likely person to work with. At that point, he was certainly the prominent organic chemist there.
Mm-hmm. Again, that seems to be a fairly common occurrence where people will go to a graduate school, people will advise in advance. So.
Well, Frank Westheimer was there, but he was just starting.
Yes.
And Whelan was there, but he was more of a, he was much more theoretical. In fact, he was just almost, he might have been there a year, but he started about the same time I
did. He'd just come off the work with Pauling, I guess, and so he was really very theoretical.
So, I remember I talked my way out of taking practically all courses for, I took almost no courses for credit because Chicago had a very flexible system. But I, sat in on Kailash's courses, and I took thermodynamics, and I took Whelan's course, and I took, I sat in on a good many others.
Who was teaching the thermal course at that time?
T.F. Young. Lewis and Randall thermodynamics.
20 years later, I took the course with T.F. Young. Part of it, anyway.
Yeah.
Do you remember who was chairman at Chicago at that point?
Schlesinger, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And what was George Whelan was teaching what?
Well, he was teaching a course in theoretical or organic chemistry and the application of resonance theory to organic, which got a somewhat mixed reaction, I think, from students because there seemed to be an awful lot of ad hoc explanations.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very qualitative kind of a treatment. It was essentially the combination of Pauling and the British electronic theory of chemistry, moving electrons around.
Mm-hmm. And did you sit on Westheimer's course? Did he teach a course at that particular
He took, taught a course in chemical kinetics that I sat in on,
I remember his
quite a good one.
Mentioning a course that he taught where the students were so sharp that he was, it must have been one of his very early courses, I guess it was, and I don't know if H.C. Brown and you and there were a group of other people who were really sort of formidable.
H.C. Brown was there at the same time. Now, he killed me a little bit of sleep in his class, but I explained that was at the car he had it at 3 p.m, not that I didn't know. So. A very interesting class.
You took only 2 years to complete your PhD. How did you manage that?
I was able to start doing research right away.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I really, well, I or 2 summers, I guess, in the course of that, too. And I started doing the first right away, and so this saved me a year. I was able to pass their comprehensive examinations, whatever they were called, within the first quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Since I wasn't taking as many courses for credit, I spent my time doing the research.
I see. Can you describe the sort of the tenor of the Kailash group? How was it run? Did you see Kailash very often?
I had Frank Mayo at that point. It was sort of he always had a lieutenant who sort of looked out for his research group, and so that most of your day-to-day dealings were with Frank Mayo, who got to be a really good friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And he did have, I think, seminars every other week or something like that in the evening. Students would report on them, we would discuss things. And he was usually there for that. But otherwise, you saw him when you were something important or something, or serious troubles or something.
I see.
Well, so he didn't have remarkably good students. There were a few good ones there, but there weren't. Most of them were more or less filling in pieces of projects that he'd laid out. He was almost all of the research at that point was on the peroxide effect,
mm-hmm.
mostly with hydrogen bromide, but in part looking for other reactions, did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And each student looked at a different piece of it.
Yeah. Okay. What about, did you have any feelings about Karash's accounts at that particular time? How did you feel his comprehension of the problems he was working on was? That is,
Well, I guess at that point I felt he knew much more than I did. I think later I got to know him quite well. Students tended to be sort of scared of him, although I don't think I was. They knew what he was trying to establish. It was still being worked out because the explanation of the peroxide effect in terms of a bromine atom chain reaction, I think, was worked out about the time I got there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know it was published while I was mm-hmm. there. And then he was going to write a review of this, and he asked me if I was, he and Frank and I were going to write this, and then Karash decided he didn't have time to work on it, so Frank and I wrote the review.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm sure he looked it over to make sure it agreed with that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But in fact, there was some place where I heard a rumor that his name was on the original review, and somebody objected to that. I don't know why someone would have.
His name was going to be in the original review, but he didn't tell me this, but Frank said that he decided he wanted to take it off and just leave it with us.
I see.
That was the story I heard.
Okay.
It wasn't contradictory to his views, I don't think. I think we put in some things which he may not have thought of.
Mm-hmm. So you had started the review before you left Chicago?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess it came out in 1940.
It
must have been.
Yeah, I wrote the first draft of it, and Frank and I had gone over it quite extensively before I left.
Mm-hmm.
At least I wrote the first draft of most of it, and then there was some minor.
That's quite an undertaking for a student. You've only been a graduate student for 2 years.
The literature wasn't as big in those days.
James Senior was acknowledged in that contact paper.
Probably in discussions with Frank. Boone was probably acknowledged in it too. I don't.
Remember, he looked it over as well.
He and Frank and I used to eat lunch together occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the most important new idea in that review was the attempt to show why you observed these reactions with hydrogen bromide but not with the other halogen acids on account of the energetics. I think that was my contribution to
that. Well, that was my major one to that.
It was undoubtedly stimulated by discussions with Wheeler. It might have been his idea too, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's obviously an important idea because it's now entered the undergraduate textbooks.
Yeah. Changed the numbers a little bit.
Yes,
altogether.
Yes, right. It only took 25 years to get there. Was Julius Stieglitz still around?
No, he died. Just before I got there.
I meant to check the date on that. Did you have any feeling at that time that, I don't know who was building that group of essentially physical organic chemists. The fact that I know that Karash had recruited Frank Westheimer. I don't know who brought in Weiland, and the fact that Mayo was an instructor, even though he was Karasha's lieutenant, what was I was asking you whether you felt there was any kind of concerted effort to build a program in physical organic chemistry.
I wouldn't have known about it if there had been.
Yeah.
So Frank, either Frank Westheimer or Frank Mayo might know more about that than I did. Actually, Karasha was always something of a lone wolf, and at least in subsequent years, it was really, it was one of these large trees in the shade of which other things don't grow very well.
Yes. I think I had that. I was an undergraduate in Chicago, but he died shortly after I got there, but I had that same impression from just talking to people around.
I'm sure he had strong ideas about how the department should be run, but mm-hmm. I don't know what they were.
Yeah. H.C. Brown also worked with Karasha.
He worked for a year or so for Karasha as a postdoc.
Okay, and he took
his degree with Schlesinger.
Okay. And then he stayed on for a while during the wartime period with Schlesinger, or that was...
Yeah, or whoever that group was, he was there.
Okay.
He's written extensively on this.
Yes, I haven't gotten to that, but I will. What was the... you've mentioned the Karasha seminars, and I wondered what else... what the climate was like as far as chemical communication went. What other seminars did you attend? Who did you talk to about chemistry?
No other formal ones. The only meeting or anything which I ever remember going on, Paul came and gave some lectures there once. And that's about the only event outside of Karasha's group that I can remember.
Mm-hmm. Who are the people you were talking to? Frank Mayo, obviously.
Yeah.
And were there others that you discussed chemistry with?
Not a great deal. One of the more able people in the group was only Ernie May, who went back to work for the Family Concern in Newark, which was a dye company,
mm-hmm.
and I saw him once about 20 years ago. I have no idea what's happened to him subsequently.
Mm-hmm.
But there weren't many others that overlapped with me that I can.
Obviously, you were reading papers in free radical chemistry at that time. Do you remember whose papers you were reading aside from those you quoted in the review article? Who did you think were the most influential chemists in the country, in the world?
Well, and probably cited everything I read in the review article. But I remember being advised when I went abroad after my summer of my senior year in college and being advised to get a copy of Huckel's two-volume book on mm-hmm. theoretical organic chemistry, which I duly bought in Heidelberg and took home with me and tried to read the German for a long time. The kind we were advised, for instance, just to do things like book by Hickenbottom on organic synthesis, which is that how to make everything out of everything, which one was advised to read and sort of commit to memory, and Gilman's two-volume work, that was another Gilman's. Yes. I didn't read much theoretical, it was mostly a matter of reading just committing enough organic. Very sensible feeling that one really needed to know an enormous number of facts of organic chemistry before you could begin thinking about theory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's contrasted with the freshness approach. Having listened to George Wieland, I was briefly taken with the idea that maybe quantum mechanics was the solution to organic chemistry, so I went and sat in on some of the courses in atomic and molecular spectra and things of that sort over in physics.
Mm-hmm.
Took a course in a couple of math courses, but I decided at that point it was too difficult. It was quicker to do experiments. But there was sort of a wave of that sentiment then. It appears
throughout. We're back into the cycle right now.
Very much so.
There's some question as to whether...
we have computers now, which would really help. But then the calculations were impossibly tedious in those days.
One time Rupert told me about the work that he did with Kirkwood at that time.
I was going to quote that. I mean, here's something that's just a trivial exercise now.
Yes.
It took a long time to do the arithmetic
calculator.
Right.
There was, at least from the review article, I have the impression that there was a great deal of interest in that abnormal addition problem, and that people like Lucas and Lynn and Winston had done some work, and there was work by some Japanese workers, Ushibara and
Takayashi.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Sherman, Quimby, and Sutherland.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a sense of was there a sense of competition with these other groups within the Karaj group?
Well, it certainly wasn't a part of Karaj.
Yes, I had the feeling that he was sort of combative or
good. Yeah, he was. Now, I read these papers, of course, and I was aware of the old history, and I wrote up drafts of the papers that were published from my thesis, and I remember Frank telling me that Karaj might want to change the introductions to them a little bit to make sure that they were consistent with his viewpoint, but I figured that was his privilege.
Do you remember his doing so, or?
Well, just a matter of emphasis. Because some of his early ideas turned out not to be very realistic, and he didn't want these reviews in too much detail.
I see. When you graduated, what kind of chemist did you feel you were at that particular point? Could you have titled yourself?
Well, I'm sure I thought of myself as an organic chemist, and I was had I been free to do whatever I wanted in chemistry, I'm not quite sure what I would have done, because I hadn't had the necessity of making up my mind.
Mm-hmm. Somehow you've implied that you were directed in some way.
Well, there weren't very many jobs. There was only one good academic job that came up that I heard about and got applied for, which was recommended for, which is a position at Rochester. And I went and had an interview there, and it turned out that the two prime contenders for the job were myself and Ted Cairns.
Mm-hmm.
They decided to take Ted Cairns. And I was offered a job at the DuPont Company, which was the only other job offer I got. I went to DuPont. And he went to Rochester, and a little bit later we switched.
Yes, I had the feeling.
There he didn't. I don't remember how long he stayed at Rochester or what led him to go back to DuPont. But
So you went to DuPont because there was a job there.
Yeah.
And, where are the Jackson Labs? Are they in?
They're in Deepwater, New Jersey, the Chambers Works, the big dye works across from Wilmington.
Okay.
I guess that was one of the biggest DuPont plants, and those are all their
dye industry and most of their synthetic organic chemistry work was.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what your starting salary was at that time?
Yeah, $2,700.
Everybody remembers what
that was. That's quite a lot of money there.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. What kinds of things did you do there?
Well, I started out working on azo dyes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really just a matter of synthesizing new ones and
mm-hmm.
having them tested. Although I remember even at that point being a little conscious of the fact that one wasn't quite that sure of their composition. Particularly, I was making metallized azo dyes, which are chelate, mostly chromium complexes, but also other transition metals. I never ever really bothered to analyze them.
Mm-hmm.
Just looked at the colors. And I was a little conscious of the fact that the, one of the most important properties of a dye was its light fastness. And no one made any effort to find out why some dyes were fast and others weren't, except by looking at the structures and seeing if they could see a structural correlation.
Mm-hmm.
So it was absolutely empirical. Well, I did that for about a year, and then I got sensitized to basal dye intermediate. So I was out for a while and got switched to something else. I think I've synthesized some of the polychlorodioxins accidentally as I look back at what I was making.
Uh-huh.
Nobody, but it was well known in those days that some people got sensitized to these things. If you got sensitized to it, you went and worked on something else.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked on.
Well, I noticed there was a sort of a 4-year hole in your publication record.
Yeah,
I assume that has to do with
I got a few patents in that time, and I went, oh, someone dies, and then I worked on petroleum, or oil additives, and gasoline additives, and all that sort.
Now, you were married in 1940.
Yeah.
Can you tell me your wife's name and how you met and a little bit about her influence on your career?
Her name was Jane Ann Wilson, and she, I'd met her in Winnetka. She'd gone to Vassar, graduated the same year I did. And she was in Winnetka taking care of, when her parents had died, and she was taking care of a younger brother and sister.
Mm-hmm.
And living there, and I'd met her, and we were tentatively engaged, I guess, when I went to work. But those days, here we are, you worked for a while, make sure you had a job before you got married. So having demonstrated I could hold a job for a year, it seemed plausible.
I see. Okay.
She doesn't have any chemical background at all.
Mm-hmm. Not
inclined in that direction.
Okay. If later you want to say something about any influence she's had on your career, I'll consider that. And maybe, I think what I'll do is ask you about your children later, if that's all right. Before I get on to your switching jobs, let me ask you about your impressions of the state of organic chemistry and at that particular point and physical organic chemistry.
Organic chemistry was largely an empirical art at that point. I rather enjoyed working in the laboratory and having reactions occur and getting product.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I found this a very interesting activity. There was sort of stirring interest in why things behaved the way they did. There was a little discussion of this in Peter's courses.
Mm-hmm.
But the orientation of aromatic substitution was probably one of the first things people began to try to interpret.
Yeah.
Which was still pretty empirical at that point. We have learned these rules.
Although, was it Ingold and Roberts, Robinson had some pretty hairy discussions of that in the late 1920s and the early 1930s.
Yeah, now in this was some of the outside reading in Fuller's course, if I remember.
Mm-hmm.
I think the early Robinson Review.
Mm-hmm.
Two things we read, that and then also a review article by DuPont who discovered nylon once.
Brothers,
yeah. Two things I remember we were told to go read outside of class.
So that it wasn't really making any inroads in 1940, the whole idea, even though you had been, the department was sort of oriented.
Well, it was beginning to make some. Yeah. I remember on my PhD already, Frank Westheimer asked me to discuss something which I read in the literature, which I found interesting, which was outside of my thesis research. You know, so I talked about Ingold's work on SN1 and SN2 reactions.
Mm-hmm.
Which I knew we were encouraged to read these things, and we discussed a little bit.
Okay.
It was a lucky choice.
If you were, this may be an unfair question, but if you were going to run an international symposium in physical organic chemistry in, let's say, 1940, who would have been invited?
Hammett's book had come out then. I guess it was about to come out.
Yeah.
I have another comment on that in a minute. Calvin, I guess, was probably considered active, and Lucas, certainly. Raj. Whelan. That was the most one done.
Okay.
Incidentally, at 1937, when I joined ACS and subscribed to the JCS, and the first article I remember reading with interest and enthusiasm in the first issue was Louis Hammett's paper on sigma rho reactions.
Mm-hmm.
Even at that point, I recognized it as being
interesting. You said you had a comment about
I heard Frank Westheimer talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
He just worked with him.
What brought about the switch to U.S. rubber? I know that.
Well, I didn't think I was really getting anywhere really fast at DuPont. Frank Mayo had gone to U.S. rubber.
Mm-hmm.
And they were starting a fundamental research program in polymer chemistry, sort of underlying their wartime work on synthetic rubber. And he essentially recruited me, contrary, all of which had to be kept slightly under wraps, because in those days there were rather firm non-hiring agreements between major companies.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Mm-hmm. So I had to resign from DuPont before I could have any open negotiations.
I see. Do you know anything about Mayo's leaving Chicago? I said he was appointee, but
I think it was part of money.
Mm-hmm.
But the salary scale was not very high, and this looked like a really good opportunity. How far you could expect to get at Chicago, sort of in the shadow of Garage.
Yeah, particularly he was a lieutenant. Now you moved in about 1942. This is already wartime. And,
January 43.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Tell me something about U.S. rubber and about how the groups were set up and so on.
Well, they had Fallon Armstrong, who Well, it's they essentially decided to carry out a set up some groups to do some fundamental research, both to support their program then and to sort of prepare themselves for where they would want to be when the war ended. And the director of research was, his name, I'm trying to remember right now.
Was this R.T. Armstrong you mentioned?
No, it was Tom Gibbons, was director of research, and Aldermatt was a strong supporter of this. Hubert Jordan, who was on down the line, believed in it, and Armstrong, who come with them, believed in it. So that they set up a several, sort of a physical chemical one group and an organic group, and Frank came to head the organic group, and the physical group was run by Helen and Rye Hewitt. And it just turned out to be a marvelous time, because it was just the point where you the principles were around if anybody could see how to apply them.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got there, Frank had already worked out essentially the mathematical theory of copolymerization and the mathematical theory of chain transfer.
Mm-hmm.
And gotten data showing that it worked. So this turned out to be a very exciting and productive period for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like most of these, the company wasn't very good at ever doing anything with its research. So after a while, they lost interest and this program sort of folded.
Mm-hmm. But you did keep going for a good number of years.
Yeah.
All right. Six or seven.
Went there in the beginning of 43 and I left in 49. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I went off and worked for the government for 6 months during the war.
Mm-hmm. There are a number of people you published with during that period. Of course, you, Frank Mayo was one, and Emily Briggs, Fred Lewis. Can you tell me a little bit about?
Fred Lewis was a very competent fellow. He had a master's degree from Illinois. He was a very good experimentalist, and he was full of ideas, and he really did well, the first good experimental work on the copolymerization problem, and he contributed a great deal to this. He got himself a PhD working nights at the same time. Well, he said he didn't need one.
Mm-hmm.
He was doing fine anyhow. And he ended up, I think he's now retired, but he ended up in the silicone division of GE.
Mm-hmm.
Where he worked for a while.
Did he move to GE when Frank Mayo did?
Well, he left about, I left first, then he left when Frank left.
Mm-hmm. Briggs.
But in that, also in the physical, two other very competent people who left were Ed Hart and Max Matheson, both who ended, were successively the directors of the radiation laboratory at Argonne. They went there and made very successful careers in that sort of work. Raj Ewart and the fellow named Smith, who worked with him, stayed with the company until they retired. But they worked out the theory, did very important work on the theory of emulsion polymerization.
Mm-hmm.
Really, a lot of them. A very good group there.
Yes, it sounds like it was really extremely strong group. Who's K.W. Doak?
Doak?
Doak, I'm sorry.
Well, he was another new PhD who came in about the time I was there. He left and worked in a couple of industrial jobs since. I'm not sure where he is now.
The only reason I ask is because I didn't see him as a co-author in any of your papers, and yet in the Copolymerization Review, you mentioned him along with Fred Lewis, and I assume that he.
Well, he didn't work with me. He worked for publishing things with Frank.
Tennessee.
Oh,
okay. So he would have appeared on your name. There were a couple of, I assume that Emery Briggs is a woman. And,
she's had a bachelor's degree.
Mm-hmm. But she did.
She went up in Alaska. She married a fellow and said, well, I go to Alaska.
Yeah.
I mean, she was.
There were a couple other women, at least one other, that published on those papers.
Yeah.
Catherine, someone. And these were.
I think they. Well,
women who.
There was one PhD woman in the group who then became, I think, the head of the chemical library. I don't know what she probably did. The other ones all have bachelor's degrees.
Mm-hmm. And they were mainly technicians
for
the.
Yeah, I see.
Okay. I think the paper after the Chem Review, the peroxide Chem Review, that you recommended to me was a paper with Emery Briggs on the mathematical analysis of the copolymerization in a system containing more than two monomers.
Yeah.
And
she did the experimental work.
Uh-huh.
Did the analysis, and I did the mathematics.
Okay. And did that have some practical value? Did you feel that it was a significant paper only because it was just an extension? It was an extension. The mathematical analysis that you've managed, you felt that was an important paper.
It has been used, I think, in technology.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of a further confirmation scheme work that you're able to extend it to all the components.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of as much a tour de force as an important.
Okay. You were a technical aide in the NSRD from 45 to 46.
Yeah.
How did that happen and what did it involve?
Well, I guess my wife had an effect on that because she went down to Washington to visit some friends and ran into an old friend of hers whose husband was now the head of the legal department of OSRD at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he told her that they were looking for people. So that's how I got it.
Oh. So what did you do down there?
Well, I worked for the group that were developing new drugs for antimalarials.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially I was sort of a coordinator in the office, keeping track and visiting all of the contracts they had.
Mm-hmm.
It was a valuable experience to me, and then I got to meet an awful lot of people around the country and travel around and visit a lot of laboratories.
Yeah. Now, this is already after this is either close to the end of the war or after the end of the war.
Well, the war was still on when I started,
mm-hmm.
and I stayed on the wing of the calendar year.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the chief thing I got out of it, well, was this chance to travel around. Speed Marvel was an important figure in this, and he advised me to go visit all the contracts. And I remember the war looked like it was just about going to leave, and my boss had gone to Peru because he wanted to see something. So I wrote myself up a travel order to go visit all the contracts before the war ended. And the war ended as I was going through Hagerstown, Maryland. My boss was away, and I didn't see any reason to cancel my trip. Finished my tour.
No. Were there any significant changes in the organic community after the war? The organic community or the physical organic community that you could, put your fingers on?
Yeah, there was certainly much more interest in reaction mechanisms. A certain amount of work had happened during the war. People hadn't had much of a chance to get together, so there was this fine time after the war when everybody was getting together and exchanging their ideas and everything they'd thought up in the meantime. Winstein had already started his work. And there's really quite a lot of backlog of stuff to think about and talk about and do then.
So mm-hmm. there was a real atmosphere of excitement. And to me, one of the most interesting things was that 47, I went to a Faraday Society meeting. Mm-hmm. And here we heard the British had been doing a lot of interesting work in free radical chemistry, which, about oxidation and things of this sort.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned all about that at that point.
I see.
And that was a very valuable, exciting experience to me.
Talking about the organic community and their acceptance of physical organic chemistry and what was happening after the war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there were a whole lot of people who had been, well, some had been trained during the war, and then the new bunch who were coming out after the war, many of them had been working with Winstein and Bartlett and the people who were getting the show on the road. As far as free radical chemistry was concerned, all of the principles that had come out of polymer chemistry were just waiting to be applied to other things.
Mm-hmm.
So there was really a all the stuff was piled up behind the dam waiting to come up.
I see. Yeah, that's a totally new insight into the mm-hmm. the way the spread came so fast after the war. What about the industrial attitude toward physical organic chemists before and after the war? I think you've sort of expressed what it was before the war.
There were very few places before the war who had much of any interest in it. They all. I mean, the attitude in most of the DuPont company was certainly that chemistry was... Well, I suspect Roger Adams and Speed Marvel were the big suppliers of chemists to DuPont, and they had a much more classical mm-hmm. and organic outlook. We've always had the situation that there were a few laboratories around the country which were doing important fundamental work in industry, and they keep on changing around. One company does it mm-hmm. for a while, and then another. I don't think DuPont was rather late, I would say, in getting into a physical organic approach to
mm-hmm.
organic chemistry. General Electric was, well, Frank Mayo went to General Electric, and there was fairly good sentiment for that sort of thing around there. It spread rather slowly as they began hiring the people who'd been trained this way.
I think the first time that either I heard or read about the work that you had done on copolymerization, and then I realized that it had come out of U.S. rubber. I was shocked. I didn't think anything like that would ever come out of industrial. Then after the war, do you think that industrial outfits began to look more...
Yes, I think so. As one could persuade your employer that you might be able to make the process run better if you understood why it worked.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been a mixture of empirical and...
Yes. Do you think that what they had observed during the war had any influence on that? That is...
Well, it certainly did in the polymer-based industries. And the... the oil companies, I'm sure, did a good deal of this, too, because the catalytic cracking was a major technical development during the war years in the petroleum industry,
mm-hmm.
and the carbonium ion basis of this was recognized very early.
some of them began to do it.
I had mentioned to you over the phone the Organic Reactions Mechanism Conference, and you told me that you were there. Mm-hmm. Can you remember much about the conference, anything about its origins? You already told me some of the people you remember who were there.
I think it was, its origin was Charlie Price, and I guess Paul Bartlett had a hand in setting it up. Whelan was there, he may have had. I don't know who else did. Winstein, I think, was there.
Yeah, he gave a talk. Yeah. Hammett gave a talk. And in fact, H.T. Brown gave a talk at that point. Whelan did.
On steric effects.
That's right. That's right. Non-classical steric effects, what he called it. Do you remember anything else about the conference as such? I realize it's a long time ago.
Not really, except that I felt it was a very rewarding conference to be at, as far as I was concerned. Mm-hmm. It was a good meeting.
The next of your papers that you recommended to me was the paper with Briggs, Wolfstern, and Mayo on the effect of meta and para substitution on the reactivity of the styrene double bond. And could you give me a little background on that and what you felt its significance was?
Well, it was the first time anybody tried to apply the Hammett equation to a radical reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that there was what looked like a polar effect in free radical reactions had come out of the very first paper by Mayo and Lewis on copolymerization.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd been gathering data on how this worked. They were, so I was interested in seeing if you could isolate the phenomena better by going to the substituted styrenes in the same way that one does in polar reactions by getting the groups moved away from the reaction site.
Mm-hmm. This is something that's always sort of fascinated me. I don't know if anyone's ever totally explained that yet, aside from, you know, there being a partial polar influence or one can draw structures with a partial carbonium ion.
Yeah, attempts to treat it more quantitatively have not been awfully successful, I would say. But the principle stays there. There are several ways of looking at it which come to much the same conclusion.
Yeah. I know Bartlett did exactly the same thing with the peresters and found exactly the same kind of effect.
Yeah.
And, the argument still remains of exactly what it is.
Well, Paul and I have been in close communication on that subject ever since we both started working on it, shall we?
Paper that you, the next paper was the paper on copolymerization by non-radical mechanisms, and that was a paper discussing the different products from radical carbonium ion and carbanion polymerization, and you suggested that as a tool for determining mechanisms of polymerization using different catalysts.
It works very nicely.
It does, and it has been used. That was my...
You actually, there's almost nothing that you can do to alter the reactivities in the radical reactions. You may be able to alter them somewhat in the ionic reactions because these things are at best ion pairs and sometimes they're rather covalent.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's been a very useful tool to answer that question.
And the next paper was from Lieber Brothers, and that was on the acid strengths of surfaces.
I think I probably did the work at U.S. Rubber, although I was at Lieber Brothers.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I was a little hobby I did in my spare time.
Yeah, it was sort of a nice little paper. It was another attempt on your part, it seemed to me, to quantify or semi-quantify some kind of a chemical fact. And
this approach has been used very extensively by the petroleum people in characterizing catalysts since then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I take their measurements are a bit more quantitative now.
Yeah.
I know yours were
very qualitative. Some people
they were visual.
It's hard to make them really quantitative, but this has been basically two properties of the acid catalyst. One is the quantitative one of how many acid sites there are, and how strong they are.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that has had a little trouble resolving is whether these things are acting as Bronsted acids or Lewis acids.
Mm-hmm.
And that I never got involved in.
And finally, the copolymerization chem review article. That was another monumental effort, it seemed to me, with Frank Mayo.
Yeah.
And what prompted that one? And
well, we were asked to write it, I guess, and we also thought it was a good idea.
I see.
The most important thing in that, I think, is besides putting it all together in one place, is that it has the first real attempt to show how these things apply to other radical reactions,
mm-hmm.
or other preliminary matter.
Mm-hmm. Did the editors of Chem Review suggest it, or you said you were asked to write it?
I think they asked us to write it. I don't really remember. Maybe we thought it was a good idea. Maybe Frank and I thought it up. I'm not sure which.
This time, did you again prepare the first draft? Or
well, we wrote different pieces of it, really.
Yeah.
And then sat together. He's a very careful writer very meticulous, making sure he said the thing just right. So we spent quite a lot of time arguing about it.
Uh-huh. Okay. Of course, a good deal of it came out of the work that you've been doing.
Yeah, exactly. So,
did this give you any incentive to do the 1957 book? Was it sort of a running start on it, or did it have any effect at all on the later book? Had you begun to think about a book on it?
Well, I guess we got more practice writing things. Writing got easier. Now, yeah, it mm-hmm. probably.
When did you start on the 57 book?
Well, it took about 3 years to write. I started in the summer of 54.
So you were already at Columbia by that time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is a sort of an odd question. I talked to Charlie Price in spring.
Yeah.
And, at one point, he mentioned his QE scheme.
Yeah.
And the one thing that he said that I thought about when I knew I was going to talk to you was that he said you were never a big fan of the QE scheme, although in reading the paper, the papers that you wrote where you mentioned it and in your book, you always gave it some praise, but he said you were a detractor, and he thought that you had told him that the reason was that you had thought of it at some earlier point, but you'd abandoned the idea because there was no good way of determining an initial QE. Is that
it took me some time to convince him that you had to make two arbitrary choices and then you could start building the scale, and I finally did.
Yes. Well, I guess he knew that.
Yeah.
Somehow he managed to make the arbitrary choices. I didn't.
And he made plausible arbitrary choices. But it didn't measure one thing that he thought it did, because you did have to make these arbitrary choices.
Mm-hmm.
And
I guess one of your criticisms, it wasn't an absolute, it was always a relative thing.
Yeah. And the actual deviations from it were somewhat qualitative, just always rather qualitative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was an awfully simple model from my viewpoint. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In 1949, you left U.S. Rubber.
Yeah.
And you already told me that a couple of other people were leaving right about the same time. Were there any particular reason for that? Or?
Yeah, they were losing interest in supporting their basic research, and they got a new research director I didn't like very much, and I thought I would like to have been inquiring around about teaching jobs. I had been
teaching a late course for a couple of years over at Brooklyn Poly to sort of see what it was like to actually try to teach this stuff. Probably since they got my, they probably got my name from Morris Garage. Everybody's approached me and offered me a very large salary.
No.
Ben Standards.
An offer that you could not refuse. But, an offer that you could not refuse.
Yeah. Since I was feeling sort of restive about where I was then, I figured that I was going to have to be an industrial chemist. I might as well be an industrial chemist with a little more power, a little more money. And while I didn't do much science while I was at Lieber Brothers, I found it quite an interesting experience, and I learned quite a lot about chemical technology, and I don't regret having spent some time there at all.
Okay, now this was in Cambridge.
Yeah.
And what kinds of things was Lieber Brothers interested in?
Well, they were. I was essentially in charge of their organic research, and I was working on new synthetic detergents and formulations for them. They were. That was most of it. They were in the airwave business. We did some work, managed to develop an odorless hair waving agent. The trouble is, reduced hair smells a little bit anyhow, so it didn't entirely work. And then they decided that wasn't a profitable line anyhow. But I essentially worked on the development of new products and processes with them. Did a little. I published three papers in there.
Okay, can you tell me something about your move to Columbia? I think you were probably recruited by Louis Hammett.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, I was fortunate. I think that I tried to apply his equation to radical reaction, which convinced him I was a profound thinker. I met him. Actually, about that time, I first met him at this 1946. Well, I might have met him before. I'm not sure. I had a little bit. I talked to him about academic jobs before I went to Lieber Brothers. He knew I was interested, and then they developed some vacancies. I think actually, in all due honesty, they offered the job to Jack Roberts, and he turned them down, so then they offered it to me. In fact, I know that happened. I always felt Jack's wife, who wanted to go back to California, did me a really good turn.
That's right, he was at MIT at that time. Yeah. And you were sufficiently interested from two or three years before, so that you...
Yeah.
You made the change.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about... Louis was chairman at that time.
Louis was chairman, yeah.
And can you tell me a little bit about the rest of the staff at Columbia?
Well, they just developed sort of a gap in organic chemistry because Bill Dering and Dave Curtin had both left. And, in fact, three people left. What's his name?
Elderfield,
yeah. So that Charlie Dawson, I guess, is about the only other. And Charlie Dawson and a young instructor. The name I can't remember right now, but were the only organic chemists on the staff at that point. Very shortly, they recruited another young man named Leighton McCoy, and at the same time that they offered me a position, they also offered one to Gil Stewart. never given anybody tenure. He didn't actually come until the middle of the next year. He came in January of 53. Mm-hmm. And then the next organic chemist they added was with Ronnie Breslin. Okay. At that point, everything was doing fine.
I don't know whether Hammett was still chairman at that time, too. He sort of told me something about
Hammett,
he had some extra money, and they brought him in first as a research associate.
Well, we brought him in as a, I guess his title was an instructor, but he wasn't on the regular university budget. They got $10,000 a year from DuPont.
Mm-hmm.
So by paying him half of that, they were able to get him to come. $5,000 was about
the best bargain
salary at that point, yeah.
Best bargain you got in a long time.
Well, a full professor, I went to Columbia at $9,000 as a full professor.
Must have been a sort of a come down from your salary at Lieber Brothers at that time.
I was getting $12,500 at Lieber Brothers.
Oh, wow. I figured you were in the $50,000 bracket.
That was a lot of money. That was
That's true, that was 50.
There are very few people in the industry who are getting double the starting salary, you discover. I mean, after all, how many people can you think of now who are getting 50?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And at that point, the industrial starting salaries were about 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Was it George Frankel?
He came about the same time I did. He was, in fact, I guess he may have come the year before. He was working on ESR, and we did a couple of short collaborative projects together.
Mm-hmm. That was really a very early entrance of a physical, an organic chemist into that area.
Well, he had one of the first really sensitive machines. You had to build your own machine in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I decided I want to really ought to be able to see the radicals in a gel polymer system. It turned out you could see them perfectly well.
How did you start building a research group? How did you go about choosing graduate students?
Students you could get, of course.
They come around and see each of the instructors.
I got a little money to hire a postdoc to get myself started, and I got a Chinese student named Chang, who turned out to be a very careful experimentalist, who's, I think, now eventually took a job at DuPont. And the first student I got was, I guess I got rather promptly because he, forget what had happened. Well, he was all ready to start research, I guess. And we found Shelley Buckler, who is now well up in the Polaroid Corporation somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I just slowly accumulated them.
To make any comparison of graduate students from that day to graduate students today?
Well, as many other people have said, I think they probably expected to work somewhat harder in the late 50s than they did later. You tended to get, the kind of students one of were recruited at Columbia in general tend to be a very hard-working type.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're any smarter than they are now.
Mm-hmm. You were chairman at Columbia from
63 to 6, I guess, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They have a rotating chairman.
I see. Was there anything that you felt characterized your chairmanship that were any high points that
We won some and we lost some. Yeah. Lost Harry Gray and Martin Karplus, but I hired Nick Turow and George Flynn and
you have any particular philosophy about leading a chem department at that time. Or...
Well, that was sort of the peak of the, we're approaching the peak of the boom and government support and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
I used to tell my colleagues it would be a good idea to go on being nice to the industrial visitors, because someday they mightn't be so eager.
After you entered academia,
yeah.
I assume you did some consulting.
I've done quite a lot, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who were you consulting for, or who you've been consulting for?
Well, I consulted for Lever Brothers for a long time after I left them.
Mm-hmm.
I consulted with Celanese for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one time or another, Union Carbide, Chevron, Sun Oil Company, two or three others for a short period.
Do you think that had an influence on your academic research? Did it support any of it, for example?
Got very small pieces of support out of it sometimes, but never, mm-hmm. never very much. I don't know that I ever really did much of any research which was very close at the university, which was very closely connected with
mm-hmm.
any of it. But I do think that I'm sorry that industry isn't making as much use of consultants as they did before, because to me it's one of the, they always worry about the fact that there isn't enough mutual understanding between the academic world and industry, but this is one of the cheapest and easiest ways to give people some idea what their problems are and
mm-hmm.
doing something about it.
See, and you think they're cutting back on...
Well, they certainly did cut back on it enormously in the early 70s, and whether they've come part way back or not, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Your move to Utah, you've commented a little on that in various and sundry journals that have
yeah.
asked you about it.
Yeah. Well, I sort of felt like I wanted a change, and I was tired of the thought of spending my rest of my life commuting into New York from Montclair, New Jersey, because my wife didn't have any interest in moving any nearer to New York.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't appeal to me very much. The all the troubles at Columbia didn't improve my morale, although they, I thought the chemistry department behaved quite sensibly.
These were the student troubles
yeah.
in the late 60s?
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm.
One of the things that convinced me that, you can take this out of the record, but one of the things that convinced me that Columbia didn't really know what it was doing very well was the time that they got themselves involved with the cigarette filter business, which you might remember.
Vaguely, I remember.
Well, anyhow, some chump up in the medical school allowed himself to get persuaded that this promoter had developed a marvelously effective cigarette filter. And then you could make a perfectly good argument that if somebody had done this, since you can't get people to stop smoking, it might be a good idea to have them smoke better filtered cigarettes. But when I read about this, I went sort of meeting where they announced it to the press, and then I called up somebody up in the administration and said, "Do you really know anything about cigarette filters? You may be needing some technical advice." I said, "Oh yeah, but in a few weeks I got a desperate phone call, somebody high up in the administration, and I was involved in getting them extricated from the project.
Okay.
It was a little nice, straightforward, simple applied physical chemistry.
Let's see, what year did you take over as editor of the journal?
Journal, I've had it for 5 years now.
So okay. And what prompted you to do that? It was.
I'd just gotten off of a couple of things, I guess. And Bryce Crawford called me about it at a time when I guess I was feeling somewhat susceptible, so I went and thought about it. Mm-hmm. I just finished being the chairman of the Committee on Professional Training of ACS, and a couple of other things.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been interested in the enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Has it consumed a great deal of your time?
Yeah, quite a lot. But I don't regret it. I think I wanted to. I told him I'd do it for 2 more years, and I'll be 65 then, and I'll see what I want to do about it then.
Mm-hmm. General question.
Radicals is probably the most satisfying thing I ever did, because I actually got it done, and it really had quite an impact.
Yeah, certainly.
I wrote it at the right time, really.
Mm-hmm.
Many years of consulting, I was once connected with one very successful product.
What was that, if you could?
That's Celanese, they make a polyformaldehyde, which is plastic named Celcon.
Mm-hmm.
And my name is on their basic patent. What I'm particularly pleased about with that is, having had this discussion about how they should solve the problem, I went home and I said to myself, this is such a good idea that if it works, we better get it on the record. So I sat down and carefully wrote them a letter about it.
Mm-hmm. So
which gave them a nice early date of conception and also established who'd done it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as an old DuPont employee, the fact that DuPont then sued Celanese and finally had to drop the suit on
of your letter.
Pardon my letter. Having students who have gone out and done things successfully have been a satisfaction to it.
Mm-hmm. Back in the late 20s, the early 30s, there was a gap that Hammond pointed out. Around the turn of the century, Lapworth was already starting to do kinetics,
yeah.
And people like Stieglitz and Neff and even Arthur Michael were talking about mechanisms. And yet, there was sort of a gap period, at least in Hammond's eyes. There was a gap between the early 1900s to about 1925 or thereabouts, before people started to get interested again in organic mechanisms. Can you think of anything that might have stimulated the interest of more people?
I'm not as conscious of there being a gap, but it's the thing slowly moving along little by little, and somehow or other one had to make enough useful things that finally developed something of a critical mass, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And enough little pieces of this turned up that it looked as though you could put it together. The idea of a carbonium ion as an intermediate was suggested back in about 1920 in connection with the
Mirwine
terpene rearrangement.
Mm-hmm.
But it took a while for it to work. And then there was this rather sharp dichotomy between physical chemists, who actually measure kinetics and do things like this, and organic chemists, who were sort of reared in the idea that this thing was an art.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Adams, rather late in his career, I know, was being quoted about no useful thing had ever come out of his career. No useful new reaction had ever been discovered this way.
I see.
Which I think is no longer true at all.
can hardly put a date on things like this, but how would you characterize the change in emphasis from classical organic chemistry to more of an integrated approach that, that perhaps we have today, which is sort of a combination of physical organic plus classical organic, which is now what we call organic chemistry?
Well, it sort of moved down slowly from the graduate schools into the teaching. You mean, when did it occur, or why did it occur, or what?
All of those questions.
Well, it really occurred between the mostly during the 50s, I guess, mm-hmm. late 40s, early 50s. Because in the early 50s, when you taught a graduate course in physical organic chemistry, this is all new to the students. They simply learned a good deal of descriptive chemistry. And it made it a marvelous time to teach it. Mm-hmm. Much less satisfactory to teach now, because they've been getting watered down versions of it ever since they started.
That's right.
And they sort of gotten bored with it.
Yes, yes. You're just adding more detail.
Yeah,
in a sense. A few years ago, I talked to Phil Skell. I was starting this project, and he said he felt physical organic chemistry was dead, and that those who were practicing it were merely adding more digits after the decimal point to already well-known numbers. And do you have any thoughts on physical organic chemistry today? Whether
much of it is fairly dead, but the techniques are certainly absolutely the fundamentals of all the work on enzyme reactions and things of this sort, all that area of biological chemistry. The application of these principles and their use in organometallic chemistry is really just getting started, and it's quite active. And photochemistry is probably a little over a peak, but it's still learning interesting things. Many of the classical problems are sort of exhausted, but they're...
I just have the impression that they're beginning to expand the horizons of...
It's had this, like any field of chemistry, has this bad habit of running in fads, and the peak of publication in any area is sometime after the peak of interest.
Where do you think physical organic chemistry is headed, or organic chemistry in general is headed, at least now?
Well, the big area is certainly getting over into biological chemistry. Where else it's headed, I don't really know. I've been to various inspirational meetings about... I went to a workshop on physical organic chemistry that NSF ran a couple of years ago, with everybody sat around telling each other how great everything was, but I thought it was good. But there's still quite a lot to do. There are a lot of things that aren't understood, and there are lots of interesting phenomena. Much less is known about oxidation reduction processes and is known about solvolysis and displacement, for instance. And I think this is beginning to, when you see how complicated the oxidation reduction processes are in photochemistry. So I've been listening to this meeting. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a lot of very interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And as a basic approach to, really technical problems, trying to improve processes, it's one of the most powerful tools one has available. The whole area of how heterogeneous reactions operate is still quite mysterious. And that's what I would say to the major
problems.
Unsolved problems,
Okay. Okay, just a few other questions. I told you before I was going to ask about your children. You're listed in Recommended Science as having five.
Five children, none of whom have gone into science or shown any particular interest in it. The nearest came to it was my second daughter, Mary, a chemistry major. Although he is no longer. He is now technical sales IBM.
I see. So maybe you had a negative influence on them.
I didn't have a positive influence on them anyhow.
Mm-hmm. I'm considering doing a benchmark papers book, perhaps there's no time to list it, but if you have any all-time favorites in physical organic chemistry, I appreciate your letting me.
Hammett's paper on both of Hammett's papers on the Hammett equations. I mean, both the acidity function and the other one.
Yes.
Oh, I don't know what other ones. Some one or two of the early Weinstein papers certainly are. George Hammond's paper on the first one on the.
There's the energy paper.
Yeah, the single triplet reactions of benzophenone, yeah.
Uh huh. Yeah. I was thinking of another one.
Yeah.
That,
I think that many people would consider his one on the Hammett postulate more fundamental than I do, because I sort of felt the idea was a.
It is sort of a statement of something seemed.
But it's certainly been quoted.
Yeah. I guess my final question is you know most of the people I've talked to so far. Are there any others that you think it might be useful for me to talk to in terms of. The sheer development of physical organic the earlier years.
I don't know.
I think talking to Frank Mayo might be a very good idea. I had not thought of it before.
He could tell you something about the politics of Chicago. Anybody that you might have been likely to have missed now. Ernie Grunewald might want to tell you something about. He was one of Weinstein's early students, Jack Roberts.
Yes, I've been in contact with Jack Roberts.
Yeah.
And like you mentioned Saul Cohn before as being a cohort of yours, and I hope to get him into Spall sometime.
But there are really very few people who got into it before I did and were still around.
Yeah, right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I appreciate it.